infinite complacency, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Well, if you ask me what it feels like to be a freak.
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Why don't we have a little symphony of science to get us started this evening?
So, what are we really made of?
Dig deep inside the atom and you'll find tiny particles held together by invisible forces. Everything is made up of tiny packets of energy born in cosmic furnaces.
The atoms that we're made of have negatively charged electrons
whirling around a big bulky nucleus.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
Suppose that little things behave very differently than anything big. Nothing's really as it seems. It's so wonderfully different than anything big.
The world is a dynamic mess of jingling things. It's hard to believe.
The quantum theory is so strange and bizarre. Even Einstein couldn't get his head around it.
In the quantum world, the world of particles, nothing is certain. It's a world of probabilities.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
All crazy things that things really are like.
Electrons act like waves. No, they don't exactly. They act like particles. No, they don't exactly.
We need a theory of everything. Which is still just beyond our grasp. We need a theory of everything. Perhaps the ultimate triumph. The ultimate triumph of science.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. It's made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
I gotta stop somewhere. I'll leave you something to imagine.
Well, hello, and tonight our lecture is called Expanding Our Horizons: Matter, Space, and the Universe. And this lecture explores the almost unfathomable scales of theoretical physics, from the mysterious properties of dark matter to the depths of our universe and beyond. Experiments, like the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva that smashes together protons at high energies, tells us about the smallest length scales we can observe today, while measurements of the universe stretch our observations at large length scales to their limits. Theoretical physicists like Lisa Randall, which we're going to hear from tonight, tie the results of these experiments to mysteries about our universe. Professor Randall will tell us about the Higgs boson discovery and its implications. She will also explore possibilities for the nature of dark matter and of space itself. Can there be an unseen extra dimension in our universe? Theoretical physics truly knows no bounds. Hope you enjoy Expanding Our Horizons, Matter, Space, and the Universe by Professor Lisa Randall.
Good morning. I always find it amusing. I do both physics and writing, and I find that I like doing writing in the morning and science at night. So I'm always impressed that people show up in the morning for science talks. So I hope you all had more coffee than I did. So I couldn't remember what title I proposed, so I put up the title of my book. And it will be kind of a running theme. The title of the latest book I wrote is Knocking at Heaven's Door, and it really is about two things. And it's about, and I think it has to do with also two ways of presenting science, which whenever you're giving public lectures, especially in a venue like this, it's interesting to think about. Because, I've debated with other scientists about this. I mean, one thing that you get when you see science talks is sort of just the awe and wonder aspect. You know, the fact that there are all these exciting things we're discovering about the universe. And it's true, there are exciting things we're discovering about the universe, and I'm going to tell you about a few of them. In particular, I will tell you about dark matter, Higgs boson, and a little bit about an extra dimension. So it's a lot I'm going to cover, but I'll try to give you a flavor of it. And a lot of people are frustrated. They're like, I don't completely understand it. Well, you can't completely understand very deep physics topics that I'm going to cover in a short amount of time. But you can get a sense of what the ideas are and what it is that's driving us. But I think the other thing that I always get asked about and that is interesting is sort of just how we're thinking about science. Like, how are we deciding the questions we're doing? And how are we deciding what's right? How are we deciding? So basically, just what do we do? What are the questions we have? What drives the guesses? I do theoretical physics. I don't do experimental physics, although I will tell a little bit about experiments. And it's an interaction between hearing what the data tells us and what we predict. And how do we decide what that is? And how do we decide what the interesting questions? And how do we decide what has a chance of being right? And of course, but the other thing I tried to talk about, because when I wrote my first book, War Passages, it was really a science book about the physics going on, about extra dimensions, about how 20th century physics, about a lot of how we got to where we are. The second book, I also was a little bit frustrated by reading the newspaper and seeing just how unscientific people are when they approach a lot of problems of everyday life that actually affect us quite enormously. So I tried to also talk, and I'll only give a very small flavor of that in this talk, just about what I think are important ideas of a scientific way of thinking that affects not just our attitude about scientific problems like climate change, for example, but also just how we can deal with problems in general. So I'm going to start with kind of what looks like a random picture. It's a photograph someone sent me, and you can all tell where it is. And you can tell it by, of course, the iconic Eiffel Tower in the background. And you also notice there's a kiosk in the front with a poster on it. So, of course, this is a picture of Paris. So you're saying, why am I showing you this picture? Well, because one of the important themes in, I think, physics, but also more generally, is that just how we look at something matters, what scale we use to look at it. And in this case, scale means actual size. What is the resolution with which we look at something? So if you look at, with very fine resolution, you would see the very nice iron gridwork of the Eiffel Tower, which you can see when you're standing underneath it. And of course, if you had more sophisticated tools, you can actually see the atoms of iron. And by see, of course, I'm talking loosely. I mean observe. It doesn't mean literally see it with your eyes. But as we develop better tools so that we can look at smaller scales, we see this fine structure. It doesn't tell you when you look at that atom that it's going to be an Eiffel Tower. It matters how you look at it. So if you look at the right scale, you see that it's this beautiful structure, which is the Eiffel Tower. And of course, the other thing that's important to think of when we do science and physics and just about anything else is that if you don't have the resolution to look closely, you won't see it at all. So if you're up in an airplane, if you're too far away, you don't know the Eiffel Tower is there. And I hope this is a little bit clear to you that it's a metaphor for how we do science, that when we look more closely, we find substructure that we didn't know about. And if we don't yet have the tools, we don't yet see it. And the important thing to also keep in mind is that If you don't yet see it, you can still go ahead and do science. You don't have to know everything. You just do the science that's appropriate to whatever scale you know about. So you learn about the things that we can actually observe and try to put them together into physical laws. And I just want to say that scale matters especially to me, because if you went back to that first slide I had and actually blew up that poster, you'd see my name on it. Which is why I was sent that picture. and the reason is because a composer who works at IRCOM in Paris actually asked me to work on an opera. So we had an opera that premiered at the Pompidou Center that was actually about physics and also about science, what drives creative thinking. And it premiered at the Pompidou Center. And I'll give you a little excerpt at the end. But I just want you all to keep in mind that you're using this idea of different scales all the time. Physically, you're using it when you use Google Maps or MapQuest or whatever you use. You look at the scale that's relevant for you. If you're driving across the country, you don't need a detailed map of Aspen. But when you get here and you want to find out where Dornhauser is, you want a detailed map of the Aspen Institute. And so it's important to realize that it's okay to neglect those details, but you learn more when you can study those details. And that's basically what I do as a particle physicist. We have one scale that we understand well, and then we're looking beyond that. So as, I don't know your name, but as someone was asking, like, what goes beyond what you've learned? Well, there's always something beyond, and it's foolish to think that there's not, but we still learn a lot at every given scale. And that's true in everyday life as well. We don't know the details of everything that's going on, yet we manage to function. And so we learn more, we can build on that information, we can derive what happens at other scales, but we can always do physics on the scale that's appropriate. And just the last slide just about scale itself is just to remind you, and this is, again, in response to a lot of questions I was asked after I read the first book, a lot of people almost question the reality of the kinds of things that I and my colleagues study, because it's not something you see in your daily life. That doesn't make it less real. I mean, that is just a function of physics. It's a function of the fact that we see with visible light. We see basically, although this actually tells you exactly which wavelengths are appropriate, but we basically can see things between a millimeter and a kilometer. But of course, the universe spans a much broader range of scales. The fact that we have this accident, that we just see these scales, doesn't mean there aren't interesting things to study, and that's what we do. So I'm going to give you a very brief tour of the universe to give you an idea of what exists on all these scales. So we'll just start with large scales. Notice that the human being, which is about a meter tall, everyone except for Americans basically use metric system, which I will use. So we're all basically 1 or 2 meters tall. So we're looking at scales that are larger than us. And they're enormously larger. We start off with the scale of the known universe at the top, 10 to the 27th meters. That's a 1 followed by 27 zeros. That is an enormous scale. That is the scale of the universe. And you might say, why is it a finite size that I'm looking at? Why isn't it an infinite size? And that's because I'm talking about the visible universe, because I want to emphasize what are the things that we can actually observe. Because the universe has only existed a finite amount of time, and because the speed of light is finite, we can only see out to a certain scale, which is our universe. That doesn't mean that there aren't very interesting things that exist beyond, but this is the stuff that we can make predictions about and actually observe with astronomical or other tools. Now, of course, within the universe, there are many other objects of many different sizes. So there are galaxies, 10 to the 20th meters. There's this Earth's orbit, 10 to the 11th meters. And there's the Earth itself, 10 to the 7th meters, 10 million meters. But what I want you to think about when you think about this vast range of scales, 27 orders of magnitude, 27 factors of 10, is that the same laws of physics apply over this enormous range. Right? We use gravity, we use electromagnetism, the same laws of physics apply over this range. And when we get to small scales, we're going to learn that we actually learn about new laws of physics as we study smaller scales, and we'll come back to that. I just want to take a minute, since I promised to talk about dark matter, to talk about one interesting thing we learn about when we study these large scales. And of course, I think most of you probably know this, but one of the many surprising facts about the universe is that ordinary matter is only a small part. That is to say, if you do an energy count, And you ask, how much of it is stuff that we're made of, the kind of atoms we know about, the kind of stuff we can actually study in our laboratories so far? It's only about 4% of the universe. There's another about six times as amount that's dark matter. These numbers are actually old. About 70% is dark energy, which is energy not even carried by matter. It's just energy spread throughout the universe, not associated with individual particles. Now, I said it's one of the many surprising facts, and I think most people, when they see this, think it's surprising that we're such a small part. I actually think that it's quite remarkable that we're as large a part as we are. I mean, this is just an accident of what we can observe and who we are. And there's no reason that all of these components had to be so close that you could actually see the slices of pie on this chart. It could have been that we were 10 to the minus 5 of it, or it could have been that we were a very small component. It's amazing that we are as big a part as we are, and I'd like to think that that actually might be a clue as to what dark matter and dark energy are, because why should all of these be so similar? Why should this other stuff that we think is hardly interacting with us except through gravity be so similar? It kind of points to the fact that maybe there are other interactions. So what is dark matter? I guess I should have said that already. But what is it? It's matter. It's stuff. It clumps. It comes in. You get it in galaxies. You get it in stars. But it has gravitational interactions. That's what we know so far. But we don't know what it actually is. Right? Ordinary matter, we know it has other interactions. It's charged under electromagnetism, for example. We don't know what it is. We think it's particles. We think it's just particles that don't interact with light. In fact, the name is kind of a misnomer. It's not dark. It's transparent. You can see dark things. There's some bright stuff, but you can see the rug. Because it's absorbing light. But dark matter is just not interacting with light at all. And we know it from its gravitational effects. I'm not going to go through all the details now, but there are many different ways that it affects the structure of the universe that we can actually go out and measure. And when I say me, I mean my observational colleagues. Me. So what is it? Well, we don't yet know, and that's one of the things that I, as a theorist, work on. It's a question we're trying to solve. There's a lot of attention devoted to it right now, in fact, and that's for two reasons. I think it's because, having not yet figured out what it is, people are trying to explore broadly what are the possibilities for what it can be. And the really interesting thing about that is that there are several different ways that people are looking for dark matter today, both through very sensitive detection experiments where it can recoil a little bit and leave a tiny bit of energy, or by seeing dark matter particles annihilate in the universe, or even at the Large Hadron Collider, the giant particle accelerator that I'm going to tell you about. So there's lots of ways people are looking for it, and so it's important to have a broad spectrum of ideas about what it can be. What are these experiments telling us? And I say at the end, prejudice can distract us from the truth, because I think a lot of the time people just think, I know what dark matter is. I have an idea of what it is already. And they're not right. And you can tell that because you go out and try to measure things. So you have to have an open mind, and that's a very important quality when we're doing our research. There's a lot of words on this. So I'm just going to tell you very briefly one of the interesting ideas I'm working on. For those of you who are interested, I'll be talking more about it at the BBC radio thing at the Jerome Hotel at noon tomorrow. But it's an idea that maybe not all, just like in our universe, we have all sorts of different particles. It's not like there's only one element of matter. There's many different ones, and they have different interactions. Maybe this dark sector is like that, too. Maybe some of the dark matter has strong interactions, some of it has less interactions. Maybe there's even something that I like to call dark light, a kind of electricity that we don't experience, that this other matter can experience. And it turns out that that gives rise to all sorts of interesting consequences, both in structure, in terms of observations. You can have that. One of the really exciting ideas is those of you, you know, when you look out into this beautiful sky that you get here in Aspen, you can actually see the Milky Way, the plane of the Milky Way. So a galaxy actually has a disk, which is a flat structure, surrounded by a big halo of dark matter. The reason that disk formed is because matter itself, the kind of matter we know about that interacts with light, could cool down into this flat disk. So it gets less and less velocity as it cools, and it gets into a very narrow structure. Maybe some of the dark matter is like that. And if that's true, it's denser and really interesting, and probably right on top of us, and can give a lot of interesting consequences that we're studying. So I'm not going to say any more about that. So just to get back to the idea theme, just we believe dark matter exists. It's been observed through experiments or observations having to do with its gravitational effects. But we're trying to figure out what it is. We try to figure out what it is based on other things we know about the universe, other possibilities we know about what forces and interactions can look like. And all the time, we're trying to push the testable possibilities to try to find out what it is. I find it ironic that while we're talking about dark matter, the lights went off. Okay. So we're open to even weird possibilities if they're testable, and we take that into account. And it's a really exciting topic because it involves lots of things, cosmology, astronomy, and particle physics, the study of really tiny stuff, which we're now going to turn to. I told you I'd cover a broad range of ideas. So we're done with large scales. We're now going to move on to small scales. So scales smaller than a meter, smaller than the human scale. So here, the human being's at the top. Okay, so now we're going to ask what we get as we look at smaller and smaller scales, smaller than a meter, as we have a resolution that can detect smaller things. And I actually start off by talking about a few biological things to emphasize that even in understanding our own bodies, until we actually did experiments to look inside, people didn't even understand the circulatory system until bodies were cut open and arteries and veins were found and the mechanism of the heart was understood. Certainly red blood cells weren't known about until we looked under a microscope and could see them. And DNA was found because of X-ray diffraction, that you could see the structure, the helical structure. So even in understanding stuff about ourselves, we learn a lot more when we can look inside. And with physics, of course, we're going to go well beyond that. We're going to go to tiny, tiny scales. That's why we have these enormous accelerators that probably most of you have heard about, because you're trying to study structure that you'd never see unless these tools existed to allow you to look at these very small scales. And when you do look at these small scales, you learn an enormous amount. You learn about atoms, for example. You learn that all the stuff that we think of as solid is actually mostly empty space. It's mostly electrons that are surrounding nuclei an enormous distance away. Most of it doesn't actually have matter in it, even though this thing seems pretty solid. I hope so, or else my computer gets destroyed. So it's all very solid, but when we look inside, we see that they're actually atoms. So when we look inside those atoms, we see that they're nuclei surrounded by electrons. We look inside the nuclei, we learn about protons and neutrons, and we learn about objects called quarks. And that's what those of us who do particle physics study. It's called the Standard Model of Particle Physics, and it's the structure that describes everything we know about so far, the most basic elements of matter and their interactions. And right now, the frontier scale is 10 to the minus 19th meters. That's 19 factors of 10 smaller than the human size. It's a really small scale, and that's at this machine called the Large Hadron Collider, LHC. It could have been called the Large Proton Collider, and then you would understand what that means. A proton is a form of a particle called hadron that experiences what are known as strong interactions. And it's 27 kilometers in circumference. Protons are accelerated around. Each time they go around, they get another kick, which is why it's circular. And they get accelerated to enormously high energies with which you can study very tiny distances and look inside and find out what's going on at smaller scales than we've ever studied before. And for many reasons, we think this is about the interesting energy range that we really want to study. And I'll tell you a little bit about the major discovery that we had about a year ago. And again, I just want to emphasize, because, again, referring to the question that was asked before I even started, like, what's next? And I just want to emphasize that every time we look inside, we see smaller structures. And so when we look inside atoms, we see nuclei surrounded by electrons. When we look inside nuclei, we see protons and neutrons. That's what plus and zero are. And we look inside those, we see quarks, objects called quarks, the up and down quark. It's inside all the nuclei around you. There are heavier versions of quarks. They decay. They're not stable. And that's one of the things that we study, just all these elementary particles. And the question is, why are these particles what they are? Why are the forces what they are? Why do they have the masses they do? What is driving the structure that is fundamental to everything we see? And again, we can study all the stuff we see without knowing the answers, but when we know the answer, we have a lot more information about how to put it all together and what are the fundamental laws of physics. And I really like this quote because when I wrote my first book, Warped Passages, I realized I hadn't actually read a lot of books for popular audience, so I just went and glanced through some of them. So George Gamow, wrote very good books, and he did indeed. He was actually a nuclear physicist. It was in 1947. He studied the nucleus, which was the frontier scale in 1947. No one yet knew about quarks or all this more fundamental structure, but they had discovered the elements of the nucleus. So he was very excited, and so he said, instead of a rather large number of indivisible atoms of classical physics, we are left with only three essentially different entities, protons, electrons, and neutrons. So that is the scale at which they understood things at that point. People tend to do, and said, thus it seems we have actually hit the bottom in our search for the basic elements of which matter is formed. So even though he was so excited that they had just discovered this substructure and understood that these were the elements of matter, he didn't have the foresight to say, you know, maybe we've only studied up to a certain scale, and if we can study it even more, maybe we'll find some substructure there. And of course, that did happen in the 60s, and quarks were discovered. These other more fundamental elements. And as I said, the frontier energy scale today is 10 to the minus 19 meters. We say it in terms of an energy scale, tera-electron-volt scale. That's how we measure our energies. But you see, it's this enormous, this is drawn above ground, but of course it's a tunnel below ground, about 100 meters below ground, in fact, on average. It had to be built on a tilt for various reasons because, as you can see, it's kind of an interesting geological area. There's mountains, there's a lake, so they had to be pretty careful when they built this tunnel, built the experiments, because the experiments shift slightly over the course of time. But these are the two major experiments from the perspective of this talk. It's called CMS and ATLAS. They're what are called general-purpose experiments. So the Large Hadron Collider is the machine, the things that bang together, accelerate and bang together these protons. Then the experiments that study the consequences of banging together these protons are CMS and ATLAS. And what they do is they try to measure everything that comes out. So what happens is particles annihilate, they become energy, E equals mc squared. So particles which have mass can turn into energy. That energy can in turn become other particles, and that's what we're looking for. Now, most of the time, it's going to turn into stuff we already know about, part of the Standard Model. But maybe one out of a billion times, we can hope to see something new. So one of the challenges of the experiments is to measure all the properties, keep only those things that can be potentially interesting, and then sort through this enormous amount of data. So I'm just going to show you a couple of small videos that show you a little bit what happens when these collisions happen that was made by someone who worked on the ATLAS experiment. So what happens is the protons first go around smaller rings. You don't usually hear about those. And then it goes into that big 27-kilometer ring. And then there's a big tunnel. You can actually walk around it. And in fact, because the machine is off, you can go visit now and walk around the tunnel and see these experiments up close if you're interested in Geneva. And then protons come together. They collide. And where they collide, they'll build experiments. So usually the beams are passing each other. Then they divert them with magnets, and then they collide. And when they collide, we hope something exciting happens. Something big always happens, but like I said, a lot of the time that comes out is just going to be ordinary standard stuff. What we're looking for is what is new, what's beyond that. So we have to characterize everything that's measured so that we can tell what is the needle in the haystack that we're looking for. So what you have after that collision, so they collide, it goes through different layers that surround this collision region. And so each of these layers is measuring different properties of whatever comes out, such as does it carry charge, it's measuring momentum, it's measuring energy, measuring does it experience a strong force. So this particular video was made about a particle that actually is in the Standard Model. It's called the Z boson. It's like a heavy version of a photon. But it decays into the particles that they actually measure. And that's another thing to keep in mind about all of these. Often heavy particles decay. So what you're measuring isn't the actual particle. You're measuring the decay products. You're measuring what it turns into. And you look at what it turns into and try to figure out what was there. And in this case, you figure out it was a Standard Model particle. But sometimes, if you're lucky, you might find something that's not so standard. That's just to say I did visit. Okay. So what are we going to learn? Why are we doing these measurements? And when I say we, I mean my experimental colleagues. We're going to learn, first of all, how elementary particles acquire their masses. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in a moment. It's very subtle, But it's a very interesting topic. And we've actually answered that question to a large extent very recently. Another question that has to do with something even more fundamental that we hope to learn is the question of what explains the weakness of gravity. Now, I understand we're in Aspen, and you definitely feel gravity when you're hiking, but that's because the entire Earth is acting on you. As far as fundamental particles go, if you had just tiny objects, the force of gravity is over 40 orders of magnitude smaller than the force of electromagnetism, for example. It's only because you have big, massive objects that gravity seems so strong. Gravity as a fundamental force is actually extraordinarily weak. And not only is it really weak, but it's actually a mystery in the context of quantum mechanics and special relativity why it's so weak. Because if you just did a calculation, you would think that all the forces should be about the same size. And the question is, well, how do you get away with this, what we call fine-tuning? What is the fundamental physics that underlies that and gives you something more interesting? And it turns out it's a really hard problem to solve. People have been working on it since the Standard Model was put together in the 1960s and 1970s. And we really don't know the answer. So again, it pays to be broad-minded. So the answer could have to do with more symmetry. Maybe some of you have heard of something called supersymmetry, which I'm not going to have time to talk about here. It could actually have to do with an extra dimension, which I'm going to tell you very briefly about. And the other exciting thing that the Large Hadron Collider could in principle tell us about is about dark matter. And that would be if dark matter particles happen to be the mass that you could produce at the Large Hadron Collider. Now that seems like a wild guess, except it actually turns out it's motivated by theory. It turns out that if a particle has that mass, and you just calculate how much of it is left around today as the universe goes from very high temperatures and cools down, that you have just about the right amount to be dark matter. So it could just be a coincidence, or it could be telling us something fundamental. So people are looking for dark matter also at the Large Hadron Collider. So again, one question was answered, and I say as of this summer, meaning last summer, and that is the question of how elementary particles, not all particles, how elementary particles acquire their masses. And that's because this particle that probably most of you have heard of by now called the Higgs boson has been found. And it really is a spectacular discovery that gives insights into the Standard Model. And they tend to show pictures that look like this, which probably are totally meaningless to most people. But it just shows you that the Higgs boson has decayed into particles that they can measure, that they can put together and say, these all have the same mass, and this has the right properties to be a Higgs boson. Because after all, the Higgs boson is associated with particles getting their masses. That means it interacts more with heavier particles, less with lighter particles. And so you can figure out how often it should decay in different ways. It doesn't always decay the same way, but you can figure out how often it should decay into different types of things. And that's what's being studied now to see, does it really have the properties of a Higgs boson? And is it really telling us about how particles acquire their masses? So what is it? Well, it's a particle associated with particle masses. And I say this very precisely because it's associated. A lot of the time in the news or you'll hear things like the Higgs boson gives particles their masses. This is probably a subtlety that you don't actually care about, but if you want to be smarter than your neighbors, it's not the Higgs boson that's giving particles their masses. It's something called the Higgs field, and I'm going to come back to that. The Higgs boson is almost an appendage that tells you that this mechanism is right. But of course, you know it's not the Higgs boson because we haven't seen the Higgs boson before. So if it required the Higgs bosons to be around, nothing would have had mass before. It's actually something called the Higgs field, but the boson is closely associated with it. So we know what to look for. And this is what I just said. So what do I mean by a Higgs field? Well, you probably know a little bit about magnetic fields, for example. It's stuff that's spread throughout space. So, for example, if you hold a magnet near a refrigerator door, you feel something even though there's nothing in between. And that's because although there's no particles in between, there's no mass in between, there's actually a field in between, the magnetic field. The Higgs field is something that's spread throughout all of space. So it's a little bit as if there are like charges throughout space. It's not exactly this, but you can think of it a little bit as charge. Not actual matter, but charge spread throughout space. And particles interact with that charge. And in interacting with it, they acquire their masses. So it's not actual particles, but it's this field, this Higgs field that's spread throughout that gives particles their masses. So why do we care so much about the Higgs boson? Well, first of all, the discovery of this particle tells us that that's right. We didn't know for sure it was right. That's what we all thought. And the reason we thought you needed this mechanism was because otherwise you get nonsensical predictions. If you just said particles had masses from the get-go, it would be nonsensical. There has to be some mechanism, and most people thought this Higgs mechanism was right. By the way, Higgs is named after the physicist Peter Higgs, and he and a couple of other people worked on this idea. So that's the Higgs field. The particle tells you this is right, and furthermore, we hope it tells us what it is that gave this field in the first place, and that's one of the things we're trying to learn about by measuring all these detailed properties that I mentioned earlier. So it's abstract, and actually when I wrote my first book describing the Higgs boson and the Higgs particle and the Higgs mechanism, it's really one of the most challenging things. Because, you know, unlike when you talk about space, it's very hard to imagine these things, because again, I want to emphasize, these are things that are happening at smaller wavelengths than visible light would even let you see. Visible light would just cover it all up. So it's really happening at these tiny scales. So it's hard to imagine what's going on if you try to picture it. But theoretically, and in words, you can understand how it is that these things are happening, and of course, mathematically. We didn't know it would be found. For me, this was a really exciting discovery. I've been doing physics for a while now, and there have been discoveries, but we always knew something would be there when they found it, pretty much. This was something we really didn't know for sure would be there, because we thought the Higgs mechanism was right, but we didn't know it had to be something like the Higgs boson that was found. It could have been a more complicated thing. It could have been heavier. It could have had different properties. The fact is, we were kind of lucky in a way that it happened to be the mass that it was, and it could be seen. And it could have decayed in different ways, but it decayed in the ways that were predicted. So now we're studying its properties more. And it turns out it does seem to correspond to the simplest model. And that's why they knew where to look precisely and found it. And it's being studied more to see what it tells us beyond the standard model. In some sense, people say that it's part of the standard model. It sort of told us the standard model is right. It's sort of the capstone, something that had to be there. And so we sort of understand the standard model. But there still are these remaining questions, like the weakness of gravity, that we're still trying to answer, and we're hoping the Large Hadron Collider will tell us something about. And so this is a little advertisement, but I had an ebook where I told you some of the ideas about this out in paperback in the fall. So where do we go from here? Which is, of course, another question that as soon as people are happy they understand the Higgs, like, so what's next? Why is the Large Hadron Collider still running? Well, there's a lot of questions that we don't answer. And those questions might tell us something even more deep and fundamental, not just about elementary particles, but really about the nature of space and time. We don't know that that's true, but those are as I said, the question of the weakness of gravity turns out to be a really hard problem to address. And it seems like whenever we find a solution, it really involves something deep and fundamental. So if we find the answer to that, we might learn something really exciting. And as I said, it could be symmetries, it could be a new dimension. So I'm going to very, very briefly, how are we doing on time here, tell you an idea about an extra dimension. Actually, we're doing okay. But I won't have time for questions. I just want to briefly tell you just the schematic of why we think the idea of an extra dimension could be relevant to answering this question, give you a slight flavor of what it is, and then give you a clip from the opera. Okay. So what are the goals today? Well, of course, we want to go beyond what we know about the standard model. So we're going to try to understand the Higgs better, but we're trying to look for new things. We're trying to take advantage of the fact that we are at this distance frontier, this scale frontier, this energy frontier. And one potential big idea is the idea that there could be another dimension of space beyond the three we know about, forward, backward, left, right, up, down. Those are the ones we see. But if I've taught you anything, I hope you realize there's a lot of stuff we don't see out there in the universe, we don't see in our daily lives. So it could even be that there is a dimension of space, very hard to picture. I can't picture it any more than you can. But we can think about it in many different ways. And there could be a dimension outside those we observe, and they could perhaps be relevant for our universe. Now, why would we think about such a crazy idea? Well, one is we actually don't know that there are three dimensions. We know we've observed three, but maybe there are more. And in fact, if you look at Einstein's theory of general relativity that tells us about gravity, it works for any number of dimensions. So maybe there are more. Something called string theory, which I think the Aspen audience has all heard about, the theory that combines together quantum mechanics and gravity, actually tells you that there are additional dimensions. The question is, are they relevant for anything we actually observe? But I think for me, the most interesting reason to study it is that it actually gives predictable consequences if it occur if they have certain properties. And it could actually explain or address the kind of questions we were talking about earlier, like this question of the weakness of gravity. So I'm just going to very schematically tell you why an extra dimension of space could be relevant for this question of the weakness of gravity with some work that I did with Raman syndrome. So you need one more big idea before I tell you this, and that is the idea of a brain world. So I said we could possibly have an extra dimension, but within that extra dimension, there could be lower dimensional objects, even three-dimensional objects, which we call brains. It stands for, it's like membrane. So if you think of a shower curtain in a two-dimensional shower curtain in a three-dimensional room, there can be lower dimensional objects where stuff gets stuck on it that doesn't get explored, so it doesn't explore all the dimensions of space. And in the same way, our entire universe, which certainly seems to be three-dimensional, maybe really is three-dimensional. Maybe it's only gravity that experiences these extra dimensions. And we really are stuck in three dimensions, which of course would explain why it looks to us like there are only three dimensions of space. So let's assume for the moment that we do live on a brain world, that is to say we and our universe and all the forces except for gravity really are stuck on a three-dimensional brain within this higher dimensional world. What Raman and I found is that the strength of gravity actually varies as you go into the extra dimension. If you have one extra dimension of space, surrounded not by one, but by two brains that bound this universe, again, rather abstract concept, I grant you. But suppose that we are on a three-dimensional brain and there's another one. It could turn out that gravity is really strong on that other brain. And we found by using Einstein's equations of general relativity that it actually varies exponentially in strength so that it could be very weak as long as you're not really just right on top of that gravity brain. So actually the strength of gravity varies as you go out in an extra dimension extraordinarily quickly, which would very naturally explain why gravity is so weak or why we experience so weak. And one of the remarkable things is that this is actually a testable idea. Even though it's this abstract idea about an extra dimension, there are actually experimental consequences. And those consequences are in the form of particles. Particles that travel in that extra dimension. They're called Kaluza-Klein particles. They're named after the physicist and mathematician who first thought about these kinds of things. They're particles that travel in the extra dimension. They look to us like ordinary particles, but they're heavier. Why are they heavier? Because they have momentum in the extra dimension. So when the Large Hadron Collider turns on again, you could have protons collide. They could produce one of these particles just like we talked about a Z boson being produced before. You could produce one of these Kaluza-Klein particles, and it itself could decay into particles of the Standard Model, thereby telling us that there's actually this extra dimension. So that was all for the physics, and I promised you an excerpt from the opera, which is just kind of fun. I don't know if the sound's going to work, but it was somebody, a composer who works at AIRCOM, again, it premiered at the Pompidou Center, and it's been several places since then. I wanted to do something. He writes electronic music where he could really use the idea of an extra dimension just to really have physics in it and explore his composing in the context of this extra dimension, but also to think about the ideas of what drives creativity for a composer, what drives it for physics. So he wanted something where there really was physics. If you look at most movies or things about science, they really rarely actually have the science in it, so it really was kind of fun to have something in extra dimension. In fact, it had more physics than I would have put in. So he forced it. But I'll just give you a little bit of a sample if I can make this work. So there were two people, one who's in the three-dimensional world, one who's exploring a higher dimension. You can see it talks about the Nobel dimension. And we had to figure out schematic problems, like where do you put the orchestra if you're in the Pompidou Center in the Grand Salle, because they don't have an orchestra pit, so we had them behind a translucent screen. He really did want physics, or he actually picked out an equation that he wanted in there. So she actually sang an equation, which I found hilarious. And he's exploring. And Matthew Ritchie did the sets, so he did the videos and the sets. And so they're trying to reconcile their two points of view. So again, just to refer to what I said in the beginning, there were two themes I wanted. What we're exploring today, LHC, dark matter, what I call the world's top model, just the model building kind of work we do, but also really ideas about what goes into scientific thinking, and ideas that I think really could be applied more broadly. What it means to be...
That means you people around you.
So presenting things with the uncertainty in what we say, how to use measurements, the role of scale, which we did talk about in organizing thoughts, and the role of truth and beauty in understanding how we move forward, and of course the role of creativity. So I'll close with one final slide. Right and wrong. What is the role of uncertainty? When we say something, we don't know it 100%. This is actually a friend of mine writes for the Big Bang Theory, so I was given the task of being in the lunchroom and be inconspicuous, which apparently I did extremely successfully.
Yeah.
Unless you know where to look, you don't know I'm there, even though I'm like right in front of you.
Yeah.
So that's basically the site. So that's why you have to know what you're looking for and where to look, because even something right in front of your eyes, you're not going to see it. So I will now stop for questions. Thank you. Yep.
How do you know when you have a correct answer to one of your various questions?
Right, and that's a great question. So first of all, from a theoretical point of view, you want to make sure it all fits together. You want to make sure that it's consistent with everything we know before, that we can work it out. But, of course, that's why we, even though we're doing theory, we care about measurements, because we want to have testable predictions. So if they found something that looks like what we said, then of course it's right. But if they don't, we won't. So this theory of dark matter, it turns out there are tons of testable predictions that people didn't know about. So we're working out what they could be. So when they look for dark matter, could they find this kind of thing? So that's why, I failed to say this, but it's one of the reasons why I think theory is so important, because experiments today are so difficult that unless you know where to look, you don't see things. So one of the things we're doing is telling them what to look for and telling them what the implications of what they're measuring are. Yeah?
How are they so sure that they have found the Higgs boson?
Right, so that's a great question. So if you have a particle, so first of all, we don't know for sure that it is the Higgs boson. You'll hear this very careful wording about it, because it's a Higgs boson. Now, why do we think it's even a Higgs boson? Well, it turns out that particle decays in different ways. It decays to photons, which I know sounds weird because they're massless, but it's a quantum mechanical effect. It can decay to photons, which are the particles that communicate light. It can decay into other heavier particles, again, and you can predict how often it should do each of these. Okay. Furthermore, when you reconstruct what those particles look like, you'll see that you get what we call a bump. Right? So if you found, took everything and then tried to deduce what was there, you could figure out what the mass of that object is, if you know its energy and its momentum. By knowing its decay products, you can figure out the energy and momentum of what was there, and you can thereby calculate the mass. So if you see a whole bunch of stuff piling up at this particular mass that isn't predicted by the standard model, you almost certainly have a new particle. Now, of course, to really know that, you have to understand what the standard model predicts, what the so-called background is. It's a very tricky thing, so you have to make sure that you really are seeing the new thing and not just some accidental fluctuation of the old stuff. But if you see that, if you see enough events, then you say, well, there's a new particle. Then you say, what is this particle? And then you look and say, does it decay in the different ways that I would predict based on the idea that it's associated with giving particles masses? So you can calculate both how often it should be produced and how often it should decay based on its mass, which was the only thing you didn't know if it's a standard particle. So you really have all these detailed predictions, and that's what they're doing. And that's why they thought it was a Higgs boson. Yep. Rick.
I'm still confused, and maybe that's normal. You have the Higgs mechanism, you have the Higgs boson, and you have the Higgs field. Are they three independent entities or effects, or are they...
They're related. Of course, Peter Higgs. Okay. So there's the Higgs mechanism, which is sort of the whole theory of how particles acquire their masses. They acquire their masses in the presence of a Higgs field. Okay, so Higgs field is an essential element of the Higgs mechanism. And it's that. This is a very quantum mechanical kind of idea. It's if you add energy to that field and it fluctuates. So, for example, if you had an electric field and it fluctuated, you could produce particles which are photons. You could produce actual particles. So if you have this Higgs field and you have enough energy, you can produce the particles which are Higgs bosons. And so when you have this giant collider, you have enough energy to make the actual particle, which is a fluctuation of the field. It's not something that's around at all time. It's not there in the background, but it's there when you have enough energy. And that part, but because that particle is a fluctuation of the field, that's why you know its properties, because it interacts with particles the same way that field interacts with particles, that is to say the heavier ones interact more, the lighter ones interact less.
In the excitement of the confirmed discovery of a Higgs boson particle, it was said on CNN, so it must be true, that this meant that we could now rewind the videotape back to the Big Bang and to before the Big Bang. Could you help a visual artist understand? Is that true?
Yeah, I can help a lot. No.
Oh, thank you. Oh, right.
We can go. So just let's think about what this means, okay? So the universe, so the standard Big Bang theory, which is ironic because it sort of tells you everything except what banged in the beginning. It doesn't tell you the very beginning, but it tells you how to trace back in time or how to go forward in time. Now, what we do know is that the universe was very hot and dense in the beginning, and then it cools down as it expands. So I told you that this energy scale, which probably is a meaningless unit to you, but it's about a TeV. So the universe starts off at a much bigger energy scale, about 18 orders of magnitude bigger, but it very, very quickly cools down to this scale. So you're looking back to this time when the energy is about a TeV. You can't look beyond that. I mean, that's why we try to make experiments that go to higher and higher energies, because you get closer and closer to that beginning, and you get closer and closer to the answers to those questions. But it's not looking that early on in time, and it certainly isn't looking before the Big Bang.
Is time linear?
Is time linear? I'm not really sure what you mean by linear.
Does it have to exist on the x-axis?
It depends what you mean by the x-axis, right? I mean, I'm not being facetious.
That's okay. If there's an additional dimension, as you describe, couldn't that involve the non-linear?
So there's often confusion about this, and it's actually is one of the more how space and time get mixed up because of relativity. What it does seem that the only sensible theories we have are theories where time has a direction and moves forward, and there's only one dimension of time. It doesn't mean it's linear. It doesn't mean that everyone scales it the same way. In fact, time gets, in addition to space being rescaled in its warp dimension, time gets rescaled, which means that the clock you use in one place could be different than the clock you use in the other. But that's sort of a question of how we're measuring time. But in terms of the actual time itself, it does seem to be something that we can only at least make sense of if there's a single dimension of time and a single arrow of time, at least where we are. Yes?
If you can please wait for the random particle. Can you please wait for the mic to sense it?
If there was a Randall particle, what would you want that to be?
well, these Kaluza-Klein, the theory that we did with the X-ray dimension is actually known as Randall-Sundgren theory. So we call it a Kaluza-Klein particle, but that would probably be the most likely. It would probably be called a Randall-Sundgren particle, or if anything got named after me, that would be it, if it was found. But probably one. Yes?
In science, there's lots of evidence that perception of beauty equals a truth, and you mentioned that in...
Often, but it'd be nice if it was. We have a whole chapter about this. Because, you know, again, this is a question of sort of how you make your guesses, what you do in model building. So people often talk about beauty as if that's the goal. I mean, I think what I would say in science is that economy is the goal. You want things to be as simple as possible, because then you can make more predictions. But, of course, if you look at the world around us, in many ways it's beautiful, in many ways it's very messy. So we're not just studying symmetries, we're studying symmetry breaking, which actually the Higgs mechanism has to do with, too. So we're not, so, you know, it's like if you look at, you know, very completely symmetric things, they're not really beautiful, they're orderly and they're nice. But if you look at something slightly skewed that's kind of a mostly symmetric but has a little bit of unsymmetric stuff in it, that actually is quite beautiful often. And in fact, that is often what happens in physics. You're looking for sort of organizing order, but then you're looking for why don't we see that order represented in the universe. So you're trying to get to a theory that's as predictive as possible. And of course, you know, but there's a lot to say about that, because of course what I see is beautiful, what you see is beautiful, what a single individual sees as beautiful over time changes. So some theories that were considered ugly in the beginning, we now consider incredibly beautiful. and theories that were considered beautiful are now considered ugly. So it's not like there's one particular criterion, but I do think there is some sort of sense you have of something being too complicated. If you have to add a new ingredient to explain every new phenomenon, that's not science. You want something that, where you can make predictions.
Is that the new book?
Yeah, in Knocking at Heaven's Door.
Do you yourself believe that there's a unified theory of everything?
I talk about that too. You know, so I'm not the biggest believer in a unified theory of everything, but even if there was a physics theory that was most fundamental, again, this notion of scale is very important. Because even if I knew all the fundamental ingredients, that doesn't explain, say, how our bodies work. You're not going to be able to derive it from those most fundamental ingredients. You're going to need what we call effective theories, theories that work at different scales, because it's just too complicated. Like, even though we know quantum mechanics and relativity, when we predict what happens when you throw a ball, we still use Newton's laws, because they're good enough at that scale at which we make measurements. So it wouldn't be a theory of everything. I think this is really important, because I think it's a misunderstanding a lot of people have, and it's in part because it's presented wrong, but when we look for fundamental structure, we're saying that that structure is essential to what's there. But that's not the same as explaining what's there. I mean, you can understand the forces that exist at that fundamental level, but then you still have a lot of questions about how it turns into all the interesting structures that we see. So those are separate questions. So it wouldn't be a theory of everything, even if it was a theory of fundamental structure. So again, I talk about that too, because I think it's actually at the root of a lot of things people say incorrectly about the role of religion and all these sorts of things, because they don't understand what it is precisely that science is saying sometimes.
A less detailed question. Where the Large Hadron Collider is in Geneva, was there also a center?
Actually at the Swiss-French border.
Yeah, was there also one in Chicago, and did that change, and why? Can you talk about where the research has taken place over time?
So basically, over time, there have been bigger and bigger colliders that have been built that can explore higher and higher energies. In fact, there was the biggest machine before the Large Hadron Collider had about 1/7 the energy, was something called the Tevatron. It was located near Chicago at a place called Fermilab. And that actually very recently shut down. So we no longer have a big high energy collider. It's the first time that we are not the country that has the big high energy collider. There's one, like we said, in Europe, but we don't have it here. There was one that was proposed for here that they even started to build that would have been 3 times the energy even of the LHC, which was the superconducting supercollider that they started to build in Texas in the 1990s, but then that got stopped by Congress. So we don't have a high energy collider now. Not yet, but we'll see what happens. Of course, you know, people. I mean, there's actually talk of a machine being built in Japan. Actually, I don't know if it'll be true. It won't be a higher energy machine, but it'll be a more precise machine. It'll collide together not protons, but electrons and positrons. So there's some talk about doing that.
What's the difference between this one and CERN? What's at CERN? Isn't there something?
So the Large Hadron Collider, sorry, I didn't clarify that. It's a machine. It's located at CERN. So CERN is an accelerator complex. It's a big research center. It usually has like one big flagship project, which is now the LHC. But they do have other research projects going on as well. And so CERN is the organization.
Lisa, thanks so much for your very informative talk. I just wanted to let the audience know, if you are really interested in these themes of dark matter and dark energy, we're going to be exploring them more tomorrow in this same room at the same time in a session that I'm going to be moderating with Dan Hooper from Fermilab and Richard Massey from the UK called We Are the 5%, identifying the hidden 95% in the cosmos. So please join us for that.
Okay, and there's also the session at noon at the Jerome if you want to hear more.
Yes.
There's a lot of stuff about physics this year. It's kind of amazing.
Plenty of stuff about interesting physics tomorrow.
Yeah. One more question there, and then I guess we'll be finishing up soon.
I'm really looking forward to reading your books. I'm a non-scientist. Where would you encourage people who are non-scientific background type people to get, who are really interested in this subject area? Where would you say, okay, start reading this now and go to here, and here? Or just look at your bibliography online? Or what would you recommend?
I always have trouble with that because, I mean, and one reason I do is I really do think there are many different readers. There are some readers that really want everything laid out for them right away. There's some readers who will know that they're not going to understand everything on the first pass. At one point, I was asked to give a list of books to Amazon, which, for like 10 best, and honestly, it was totally random because I don't really read these books. I did look a little bit. So, I mean, you're better off asking someone who's a friend, but I do like to think that you can learn something from reading my books, which is why I write them. But I will tell you, I do actually try to give the full science story. So there are some that'll have less, that seem easier, but they won't give you as full a story.
Lisa Randall and her explanation of very complex topics about theoretical physics and matter, space, and the universe. That about does it for this episode of Savage Science Radio. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the beautiful show graphics, Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that wonderful intro that we use every week, and none other than Todd Sheets, our executive producer and owner of Jackalope Radio. So until next week, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.